Hey, this is post-production Matt. If you missed it last week, we did Psychonauts Part 1. That's because we had to split up the recording into two separate episodes because it was very long. If you missed that episode, please, I highly recommend watching it first because this ends off exactly at the end of the previous episode. So if you missed that, check it out. If not, then enjoy.
I'm connecting to the internet.
Internet.
Networking software.
World Wide Web for the web. Computer today.
Computer.
NetSurfer Pro.
Go to the bottom of the lake where the lungfish kind of chases you around. It's an auto scroller through the lake. There's not a whole lot to say other than get a lot of arrowheads.
We didn't even mention one of the like big characterizations is that Raz is afraid of the water, but also the water literally tries to kill him.
Oh, yeah, he's
because
cursed.
Of a curse.
Yeah.
Yeah. A curse by a person of Romani descent. They use a different word. It was the mid-2000s.
Yeah.
We're not sensitive about that yet, but yes.
Well, his family is of Romani descent. They use a different word. It was the 2000s.
But yeah, it's an old curse that, like, the entire family is to die by the water.
Yeah. So you can't go on water. He can go inside the water because there is this big bubble of air made by the lungfish. When you knock out the lungfish through a boss fight, you enter its mind using the mind portal. It looks like a door from Monsters, Inc. So this is the first of the real levels, quote-unquote. Not just because it is, like, less linear and more complex in some ways, but because it's more adventure gamey. I want to bring up again that Tim Schafer and a lot of the Double Fine staff made adventure games before 3D platformers. And what I mean by adventure gamey is that a lot more of the levels after this become focused on, like, quests and side quests. Like, instead of just going from point A to point B, which is kind of how it is for the first three levels, it is, like, you have a larger area, and you still have to go from between different points, but it's in the context of getting items for somebody, or talking to somebody for somebody, that sort of thing. Whereas, like, Mia's is just race to the finish, Sasha's is shoot the thing, Lungfishopolis is you have to break the dam to free the prisoners, you have to disable the security system, you have to, like, you know, break your way into the radio tower. Like, there's a lot more context given to what you're doing in the form of, like, a request for somebody. Lungfishopolis is based off, like, kaiju movies in the sense that when you go inside the mind, the lungfish is the normal people and Raz is the monster.
Raz is, like, massive in their world, which is, you know, like, The size of tall buildings. You can climb buildings,
yeah,
and, like, you will destroy things if you run over them.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
You get the shield ability, and so a lot of the level is based around, like, reflecting the projectiles they try to shoot you with. So, like, there's missile tanks and laser tanks, and you can reflect those back towards the enemies.
One of the fun, interesting things is that the lungfish is being mind-controlled, and the way that it manifests in the brain is that there's a character, the Kochamara?
Yeah, Kochamara.
Yeah, the Kochamara, who is, like, literally doing propaganda. Like, you know, there's news segments that are literally him, like, reading out, you know, the terrifying Gargalore is destroying the city. Luckily, we've sent our best tanks on it. All hail Kochamara.
Yeah. It's Oleander dressed up in, like, an Ultraman getup.
Yeah.
And in the level, you're being helped by some of the lungfish in, like, a lungfish resistance, with the main one, I think, as a stand-in for the lungfish itself. Something I love about this level is the whole situation is built on the it's more scared of you than you are scared of it mentality. It's that personified, that even though to Raz on the outside the lungfish was this monster he had to fight, on the inside the lungfish is super afraid of Raz and sees Raz as, like, this terrifying, unstoppable being. But it also uses that to take out the, like, mind control that Oleander's doing. So it's, like, this really interesting look through a monster's mind, if you will.
Yeah. You save the lungfish, you free the lungfish, and The lungfish, kind of to thank you, ends up like basically being your ferry across the lake to the asylum where the big bad is. And you want to get into the asylum, but there's a guard outside who won't let you in. And you go inside the guard's mind, who's acting like ultra paranoid. And the guard starts the milkman level. The guard's name being
Boyd.
Oh God, yeah, Boyd. Boyd Cooper.
Mm-hmm. B.D. Cooper.
And the milkman level is probably the most iconic of Psychonauts.
Probably, like, yeah.
It is kind of linear, but like the trappings around it are so good because Boyd is like this literal ultra paranoid person, and so like
it's the Pepe Sylvia scene.
Yeah, it's the tack board with red yarn kind of character, and he's trying to figure out who the milkman is. And when you go outside, there's all of these like men who are literally dressed up like the you know, look for strangers in your neighborhood signs. So it's
the neighborhood watch. Yeah.
Yeah. And fedoras, and they all have this deep voice and they're all in this monotone being like, I am a construction worker.
Yeah.
This is my stop sign.
So you get the clairvoyance ability here, which lets you see through other characters' eyes. When you see through Boyd's eyes, there's a whole bunch of nonsense going around. But when you see through most characters' eyes, Raz looks different. And the way this works is, so the like shady guys, the Neighborhood Watch, have set up different like zones where you can only go through if you're in a certain disguise. They see each other in this disguise as well. So the first one you find is the road crew, which all are holding stop signs. And they're like, I am with the road crew. You must be a road crew worker to pass through. So you get your stop sign, and then if you use clairvoyance on them, you'll look just like all the other road crew workers, quote unquote. The rest of the level is pretty much this pattern of you need a specific costume, so you find the item that lets you disguise like that, and you go through the zone then. One thing I like is that everything in the level has a camera inside of it. So, like, trash cans, lawn flamingos, mailboxes, everything has a camera, and that also means everything you can look through with clairvoyance. So you do get the feeling that you're constantly being watched or that everything has eyes on you, much like Boyd believes. You go around town, it's like a very suburbia sort of styled place, except there's no, like, it's very twisty. This is another very Galaxy-esque level because you're kind of constantly shifting gravity in some way. It's not at all flat ground, which is ironic because Boyd's a conspiracy theorist.
Well, it was the mid-2000s. That wasn't a popular thing yet, unfortunately.
Sure. So the level progresses with you finding these disguises. You meet the Rainbow Squirts, which are like Girl Scouts, and Raz starts asking them, like, do you know who the milkman is? I really need milk for my cookies. And as the natural response would be, the girls run away and call him a creep. You pretty much just go through a lot of these segments of like conspiratorial intrigue until you reach the final like house of the milkman, which you find by using clairvoyance on like a spy copter. When you enter the house, you fight the leader of the Rainbow Squirts, who is like a Girl Scout mom. After beating her, you unlock like this chamber in the basement that reveals that Boyd was the milkman the whole time. He walks outside and he goes, I'm the milkman. It's time for my final delivery. And he pulls out the bottles of milk and they're actually Molotov cocktails.
Which should be noted is hinted at earlier in one of his one of his like memory safes. He like loses his job as a guard for seemingly no reason. I don't remember if like he fell asleep or something, but it didn't seem like he did anything wrong. But he loses his job, and so he fucking firebombs the place.
Yeah,
that he worked at, and he, if you specifically look, he has milk bottles and gasoline, much like he then does later.
So, something I love that I didn't notice at first, the first time I played, was that when in the cutscene where he walks out, all of these like trench coat figures come up to the house alongside sensors, which makes me think that the trench coat guys are like advanced sensors. Because their goal is to stop the milkman. The milkman is this, like, you know, pyromaniac persona of Boyd. So it makes sense that for Boyd to be healthy, they want to stop him from burning things.
Yeah.
So after you beat that level, Boyd unlocks the gate to the asylum. And he says something like, "My employer told me to burn this place down when it was ready." So it's kind of like, whenever the plan is done, burn it so there's no trace. The next three levels, you can kind of do in any order. The idea is that you're getting pieces of a disguise to go up to the top of the tower. Crispin, who is Lobato's assistant, says like, "You not have Lobato's face, you don't have his shiny metal claw, and you're not wearing his signature straitjacket." It's a very adventure game thing of needing three specific items to enter something. I love it because Homestar Runner also has this joke in Peasant's Quest where, like, you need to look like a peasant, smell like a peasant, and be on fire like a peasant. It's like the exact same concept.
Sorry, that's just really good.
Yeah. There are three levels here. The first one you'll probably find is Gloria because she's like in front of you and the entrance to the other two. Gloria, her stage is a theater doing like a children's play performance. Gloria's theater is super interesting and might be my favorite level after replaying it. The way it works is you enter, you see that the play is really bad, you hear that it's really bad from her inner critic, which is a Statler and Waldorf-esque like evil guy, I guess.
Yeah, big guy in a balcony.
Yeah. And he talks that there's a phantom that's killing the play members, and you obviously see it's him. Like, it doesn't even hide the fact that it's him. You just know it's him pretty much early on. They mention that Gloria's inner sunshine has not come out of her dressing room, and so you have to go in to talk to her. Then she says something like, you need to light the stage for me to go out. So you go get a candle from the storage room and you light up a spotlight, and that reveals the main sort of gimmick of the level, which is that there's the like comedy mask and the tragedy mask. And so every scene in the play has a happy version and a sad version, or a good version and an evil version. And so the way it works is like the set of the play is the level you're going through, and there are little portals on the right and left sides. And when you step through them, it raises the pieces of the set and lowers new ones to be, like, the next screen of the level. And each screen has its own sort of puzzle you have to achieve. And so after you get Gloria's Inner Sunshine out, the inner critic hands you a play, and he's like, "Here, have them put on this play. It's much better than this drivel." And you give it to the play producer, and she's like, "Well, it's better than this drivel." And the plays that the inner critic gives you are flashbacks of Gloria's life, and they all correspond to one of the scenes in the set that you go through, and they'll unlock a new pathway or another play. Eventually, your goal being to gather balloons above one scene so you can go on top into the rafters and the catwalks. Something really interesting is that, so every play has two sides, the good side and the bad side. And the good side is like an idealized version of Gloria's childhood. And the bad side is like the negative but also real side. So like in the good side with the knight, for example, they talk about how the knight was Gloria's father. And he was a noble man on a quest to, save the world. And then on the evil side, it's like he ran off and abandoned us. But then you look at her flashback, and that pretty much seems to be the case. So what happens essentially is that you're making Gloria acknowledge the truth about the stuff she had in the past instead of trying to put up this like idealized facade, because all the correct versions of the play are on the like dark part of the stages, not the bright parts. Yeah.
Yeah.
You...
I don't have a whole lot to add with Gloria.
Yeah, you go up to the rafters, you fight the inner critic, and eventually the inner light's allowed to shine. And, you know, after helping Gloria, she gives you her trophy from, it's like an award from acting, and that's the Metal Claw. Then you go through the door into the rest of the asylum, and you have two levels you can do in either order. These are Waterloo and Black Velvetopia. And which one do you want to start with?
I want to start with Black Velvetopia because it's my... So, visually speaking, Black Velvetopia is probably my favorite.
Yeah.
It is the most interesting. So, the framing is that there's an artist at the in the asylum, Edgar, and you ask him, like, oh, hey, can you paint me a picture of the guy? And he tries to, but then, like, there's just a bull and a matador in it, and he's like, oh, I can't get over this. You know, they'll be haunting me until the end. And so you go into his mind. And the inner version of himself is trying to build a card tower up to, like, this beautiful woman in the sky. And so you have to go and find cards. Every card is, like, a different wrestling match, like a luchador match, because he was a wrestler. It's very Mexican-inspired because Edgar Tegley is, like... That is Mexican, I believe, very Mexican coded, and like the visuals are very interesting. The framing is very fun. Of like, there's a bull that's just constantly rampaging, but the problem I have with this level is that the main thing you're looking for, the cards, every one of them is like a wrestling boss fight, and then that's kind of it. It's just sort of like, you collect the cards, you have three mini boss fights, and then the boss fight at the end, where it turns out that the bull is Edgar, and, like, the person he's obsessed with is, like, this couple that, you know, this girl that he was obsessed with in high school, and, like, the jock, or not even, not the jock, he was the jock.
Yeah.
The, like, cheerleader captain who dated her, and so, like... You fight the bull, but then you fight the matador, who's the captain, and he just kind of comes to terms with, like, they were just sort of lame people, actually.
And he was hung up for too long.
Yeah, and Raz is like, okay, are you really going to let these people, like, do you in? And Edgar's like, yeah, these people suck.
Yeah.
Like, it's very fun framing, but, like, the actual gameplay of that section feels... kind of the most linear to me of the asylum sections.
Right. So the way it works is there is this bull that runs through an alleyway, and it's cool in that it, like, makes you respect the bull. You kind of end up playing around the bull, much like Edgar is compelled to use the bull in his paintings. There's a cool mechanic where there are paintings that hang on walls, and there are these different dogs that paint pictures, and you can buy paintings from them to put on the wall. And that can help you, like, go through a doorway, or it'll give you something you can climb, like a ladder. That's pretty cool. The game, the level is like a very corridor cubbyhole thing, where, like, there's a thing that comes in every now and then down the corridor. You have to find your way into the cubbyholes, or else you'll get hit by it. There is a lot of, like, rooftop movement. It's a kind of typical city level, where you spend time on the ground and you climb up, and then that lets you avoid the bull. But yeah, the card fights are pretty much the same every time. Each luchador has its own special move, but there is a way to cheese them that works the exact same way for all of them and lets you beat them without taking any damage. And I think part of that is the same reason why I think they allowed the levitation stuff to exist is because it feels like they still want an adventure game style of, like, players solving puzzles is rewarded, in creativity and how they apply their abilities is rewarded, almost like an immersive sim, kind of like, you know, what Dishonored eventually would do.
Yeah.
And so to cheese the wrestlers, all you have to do is hit them once, use levitate, hit them once, use levitate, hit them once, use levitate. But it feels to me like that's more of a solution to a puzzle and not a cheese strat, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so to me, also, like, using levitation to skip things feels like a solution to a puzzle and not a cheese strat. I will say, though, something I love is that at the start of the level, you are basically told by NPCs that Edgar was a painter and the girl he's in love with was, like, a salsa dancer who was in love with him. but then the matador stole her away. But eventually you go into the sewer where you find all these like lockers and basketball hoops and desks, and you learn that he was actually like just on the wrestling team. All the other wrestlers you fight were the people on the team as well. He choked like a really important regional match and lost it for the team. And then he never really, quote unquote, had the girl anyways. And so what it is like Edgar's built up this like version of the story that sounds so cool and dramatic, but it's just a cover up for the literal shit that the actual story is. It's nothing. Yeah. It's sewage. And there's this great element of just unfolding the story behind him through that. It's very, very fun to notice for the first time.
Yeah.
So after you help him out, he paints you a picture of Lobato so you can wear it on your head. Now you have to talk to Fred, who is like playing some sort of game in a hex grid in the courtyard.
Fred Bonaparte, a literal descendant of Napoleon Bonaparte, and he is the like quintessential like movie crazy person trope of like, I am Napoleon.
Well, and it's interesting though, because he doesn't want to think he's Napoleon. He's like, you gotta help me, Napoleon's gonna take over my body. It's very much like Napoleon is like another personality that wants to win these games and be the ultimate conqueror. And Fred's like, I really don't care about winning anymore. When you go inside his head, it turns out they are playing a board game. Looks kind of like Heroescape. And the board game's called Waterloo. And Napoleon is winning really hard. And Fred's just, I give up. I can't win. He doesn't even try. And Napoleon's like, I will leave you alone once you complete with, you know, exaggerated fake French accent. I will leave you alone once you succeed in defeating moi at this board game. So Raz has to help him win the board game. This is, I think, the most open in, like, maybe not nonlinear, but it's definitely very wide and collectathon-y. Like, yeah. You have a large world to explore. You have to complete quests in order, but you can get all the other collectibles in whatever order you want, whether it's the baggage or the figments or what have you.
Yeah, it is, if you boil it down to its basic components, definitely basically as linear as, you know, any of the random other levels. But the like framing of it makes it feel a little bit more like open to me, especially because it's a board game and I like board games.
Yeah, I like board games too. The way it works is that you talk to different like peasantry and they're like, oh, I'll join the army if you give me something in return. Like, I want to know that Fred cares for his troops, or I want money, or I want my gun. And so the level is you talk to them, you complete their objective, you come back, they become a piece on the board, and then you use levitation to like move the piece on the board to where it needs to be, literally playing the board game more or less.
Yeah.
There is this really cool size aspect where when you start the level, you are at the same like size as Fred and Napoleon. Then you jump onto the board and you're like the same size as the board pieces. You know, they're much larger than like the buildings that they come from in kind of typical board game fashion. Then when you interact with one of the buildings, you shrink even further to like life scale, where the buildings are the size of actual buildings and the pieces are gigantic. So there's a lot of fun with like the size here. There's also a giant building near the first peasant you talk to. And if you look in the back of it, you can see the room where Fred and Napoleon are playing the board game in like a smaller room on the board game. Some fun recursion there.
Yeah.
Another kind of well-known Easter egg. So you go through this. I think it's cool that, or it's interesting that Fred's pieces are the peasantry and Napoleon is like the establishment. There's a clear like French Revolution aspect, especially because there's a literal guillotine you have to go through. And you turn invisible so the guillotine doesn't chop you. So you're on the side of the lower class, the working class. And it's interesting because it's also like how Fred sees himself, none of the peasants actually believe Fred can win until, like, you need the last person to help you. And in the same way, Fred doesn't think he can win. So it's sort of a reflection of his own opinions there, his own perception.
Yeah.
There's also a carpenter who fixes bridges, and that's pretty great because he says, like, hey, you're the burglar on my roof. I have a fire cooking under my fireplace, burglar. And so you go up to the top of the roof, you fight the sensor, and you knock out the emotional vault that was there. And then you go back down, and he's like, all right, I still don't trust you, but I can fix the bridges now. And then later you go to the blacksmith to get the rifle back, or the musket back. Oh, no, it's the guy who wants the musket. He's like, all right, now that I have my musket, I can go rob that carpenter. And then Raz is like, can you wait until after you fight this soldier? He's like, fine. And then he dies while fighting the soldier.
Yeah, he also specifically mentions, like, I've been trying to rob him for weeks, but he's had that fire on.
Yeah. There's also a great bit where the last piece you need is a knight. And the knight you need to actually capture, like, the castle and win. And the knight is like, I need gourmet food. Give me some escargot. So you go over to, like, a snail farm, and the snails willingly join you. And the snails have this huge in-depth speech about how, like, they're ready to give their lives for the country. How, like, they're willingly go into battle. It's, like, very well written, very beautiful. And then when you go up to the knight and you bring the bucket of snails there, they're like, all right, are you ready, men? Charge! And then just get eaten immediately. Game's really funny.
Also really like, so obviously the pop culture joke of Napoleon is that he was very short. He wasn't in real life, actually. He was like 5 foot something, which, you know, was a little short for our time, but was a normal size for French people at that time. Anyway, so the pop culture joke is that Napoleon is very small, and Fred is extremely tall, but it's entirely legs.
Yeah.
So, you know, once you take him out of his straitjacket, you kind of expect him to have, like, normal-sized arms to match. But no, his arms are just tiny.
Yeah.
Like, it's the exact inverse, where he's, like, incredibly tall, but has the smallest arms of, like, any character.
Yeah. Something neat is that in Fred's memory vault, you find that he used to work at this asylum, this, like, psych ward type of thing. And he started playing a board game with Crispin, which is Lobato's mook, and Crispin kept beating him. And Fred got so upset that he couldn't beat Crispin that he started to, you know, kind of lose it, I guess. Look, honestly, it's kind of hard to talk about this game with
good... just audio.
No, I mean, it's hard to talk about this game with language that is, like, doesn't borderline ableism. I'm worried about that because this game tackles, like, you know, mental disabilities and things like that. And it's hard for me to say whether that's in a respectful way or an accurate way, but it's also hard to talk about the game without bringing those up in the way the game presents them. So, like, is what Fred is undergoing an accurate representation of some sort of disorder? I don't know, but I also have to refer to it as such because that's the way the game's presenting it.
Yeah, it...
This is like a really late disclaimer, I realize, but...
Obviously, I cannot say anything as well, but I think the other two examples in the asylum are handled a little better. I feel like Fred's is a little bit more, like, loosey-goosey, just because it's such a, like, pop culture trope of, I am the character who thinks that I am... you know, the Queen of England or whatever, that it's sort of, like, played a little bit more for laughs.
I know, sort of, the thing is that, like, Fred, like, it's a very kind of negative trope of people with, like, of, like, multiple systems where, like, it's the whole thing, like, oh, the evil personality is going to take over the good personality.
Yeah.
I worry about that being the presentation, but at the same time, Napoleon is a huge jerk.
Yeah.
When you help Fred, he gives you the straitjacket, and that's the final piece you need to actually disguise yourself as Lobato.
There's a platforming section that's in the asylum. It's a collective fun of collecting the brains. It's kind of boring.
The brains give you max health, which will be necessary for the final level. Yes. The one thing is that there are these rats that explode and confuse you, and they flip your screen and make it hazy, and it sucks. It's horrible. I hate it.
The asylum jumping part is very eh. I think that is the penultimate, like, quote-unquote level, you could say. It is kind of a wet thud.
So, you go to the top, you help Shigor, you help Mr. Pokelope. They're very late additions to the story, but you do all the things we said in the plot. Then you fight the brain tank. We didn't mention this, but before you go into the lungfish, you actually fight, like, a dream version of the brain tank. And the version you fight in quote-unquote real life is much stronger, bigger, has a whole shield. It takes a lot of different psychic powers to actually beat. Then you go inside and you get what is widely regarded as one of the worst platforming levels of all time. I'm not joking. That's like a pretty common sentiment.
Yeah, it is.
It is. It's the teaser I made for the episode.
So the meat circus. Yeah. In review, the meat circus. I think that it is a. Like, it is a sharp difficulty curve for what the rest of the game is. I also think that the fact that this is a children's game does have to be taken into account, because, like, it is more difficult, and I did fail at it many times, but it is, like, in terms of difficult games, I would not necessarily rank it as extremely difficult.
Wait, but they say ass in this game. You're telling me it's a children's game and they say ass?
Listen, it's for teenagers. You can say ass in a teenager. Listen, FPG-13 movie is allowed one fuck.
It's a teenager game.
Where would you put the fuck in this game?
I'd have Sasha say it. Let Sasha say fuck. So
I would have instead of Dogen, I would have Dogen when he's talking to the squirrels at the beginning. He would say, "I'm not going to fucking kill everyone."
Yeah.
So yeah.
So Meat Circus has three segments. The first one I think is the one people hate the most, where you meet little Oleander. It's like Oleander as a kid. He looks and sounds like Chum Chum. It's horrible. He's chasing a bunny. You learn that Oleander's dad was a butcher who, like, killed bunnies, specifically bunnies. And so little Oli is trying to save a bunny. And at this time also, like, Raz's mind is mixed in. So Raz's memories of the circus is mixed in, and hence the meat circus made of meat. So what the first part of the level is you are trying to, like, protect little Oli while he catches a rabbit. You have to hold the rabbit still using telekinesis so that Oli can get it. There are also these, like, evil, gross rabbits that are attacking Oli, and you can't hurt them unless you throw them away with telekinesis. Like, I tried burning them with pyrokinesis. I tried shooting them, punching them. I don't think any of those worked. And if I threw a confusion grenade, Oli would also get confused, and so it wouldn't do anything. So I think the big thing is that the first few are pretty easy to get to in a good amount of time, and then also protect Oli by throwing things and then also let him pick up the bunny. I think it's like the last two segments where you have to do this are hard, mainly because there's just a few like pretty frustrating jumps that take a lot of time. The main thing is, like, there are these sword swallowers that throw swords at a spinning board. And you have to have the swords hit the board so that they become a platform you can ride on, like a little pole you can swing on. But if they hit you, or they miss slightly, then they won't hit the board. And if you're standing still on the ground, they won't hit the board. So you have to jump so that they hit that spinning board, and time your jump so it does it while they're throwing, and so it doesn't hurt you.
Yeah, I think here's the fix. Here's the one fix. So part of the big problem is that the ticking time aspect of this is that Oli, when he grabs the bunny, goes up to the next platform. But as he goes up to the next platform, it is actively spawning enemies that then will start attacking him on that platform.
Yeah.
And so, like, the, like, you know, just the whole like protecting him isn't bad enough, but now you literally have to platform up there as fast as possible before he dies and then fight everyone. If he was just like invulnerable or they didn't spawn enemies until you got there, it would be instantly better, because I think that that sword section, like, taken on its own, is one of the most, like, actually really clever and interesting little platforming challenges, and it is ruined by the fact that you have to do it under duress.
And you hear him go, ow! Owie! Ow!
Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing is that something that happened to me a lot is I would accidentally grab Oli or the bunny instead of the evil bunnies that attack him. And so, like, even when I'd get there at a decent time, he would take too much damage because I could not grab the actual enemies. And it should be noted that it's impossible to get through the whole thing without him taking damage. Like, you will not be able to reach him until he's already taken some damage.
Yeah.
The second section is a grinding section. By the way, there's grinding. It was a platformer in the 2000s, you know. It's
the grind really is actually easy. Really cool.
It's cool. They don't really make use of it a lot. There's only, like, two levels that have a dedicated grinding session. Grinding section? Ugh. Which are this one and basic braining. A little bit of a... what's it called? A little bit of bookending. There we go. It's cool. It just doesn't last that long. And then the last section, you are climbing up the circus while there's water rising. And you are being attacked by Raz's dad, who is throwing, like, flaming... juggling clubs at you. And this isn't too bad in my opinion. I was able to get through it pretty well. The water doesn't climb super fast, so you get quite a few tries if you fail at one section. And there's enough, like, checkpoints.
It's a water scroller, but it's not, like, exceptionally difficult.
Yeah.
I don't know if that term has been coined yet, of, like, an auto scroller that is specifically the kind where, you know, something's chasing and you have to outrun it. But I'm calling it water scroller after this game. So, put that on the TV Tropes page.
It's not as bad as Power Plant from Sonic Heroes, specifically Sonic and Dark versions. And if this game is easier than Sonic Heroes in one regard, then that's pretty good. You also do fight two bosses. There's one you fight between the second and third, which is just Oli's dad. He's like this big butcher. He's the type of thing where you climb on him, which is one of my favorite subtypes of bosses.
Yeah.
It's basically a very Shadow of the Colossus thing where he slams his cleaver into the ground and then it gets stuck, and then that gives you enough time to jump on him.
Yeah, he's definitely, like, fast. It requires faster reaction time than probably any of the other bosses, I would say. Probably kind of adds to the, like, notorious difficulty. It's just that, you know, he has obvious tells, but they require, like, when his tell is there, you press A.
Or you press shield. Press A now.
Yeah.
Shield is really good.
Press shield.
Then after the third, you fight the, like, I think it's that you fight Raz's dad first. I don't remember if
You don't fight Raz's dad.
Right.
You don't fight Raz's dad on his own. Rather, like, Oli's dad and Raz's dad kind of, like, fall into a pit.
A meat
grinder.
And
there's this voice that's, like, constantly calling to you, Rasputin, throughout the entire level, and at the end it turns out that it's actually your dad who's been psychically trying to get through to you.
And he reveals he was actually a good dad the whole time.
Yeah. Like, he sees the evil dad and he's like, is that what you think of me? And he's like, well, yeah, you hate psychics and, you know, you hate the stuff that I want to do. And he's like, oh, I don't hate psychics. I just want you to be safe, man.
It's great because, like, after he says, is that what you think of me? The evil version's like, I hate psychics and I hate you too.
Yeah. Like,
it becomes even more cartoonish at that point.
He like specifically, like, knocks the evil version down and he's like, and I have more hair than that.
Yeah. So there's two parts of the final boss fight then. The first one is that you have to dodge the cleavers now because they're on fire. You can't ride on them or climb on them. And Raz's evil dad, which is what I'll call him now, throws flaming clubs, and you can throw the flaming clubs back to damage him. Then you like the tent kind of crumbles apart and you fall to the ground. And then you have the final boss fight phase where Raz gets like a giant super avatar body thing going on. And it's basically like he grows to the size of the boss. You punch the boss and then you just run around in circles while you wait for it to recharge. There's not a lot going on for it. It's more of a suddenly you have powers thanks to the power of family. And the final boss is a celebration of family. Celebrate your family. Father's Day is coming up.
You know, at the end of the day, I think this whole game is really all about family.
Right. Yeah, it's like the final boss, I think, is kind of another wet blanket. Or like, it feels like it doesn't really... I don't know. It's like, it's very easy and kind of boring. But I get that, like, the aspect of Raz getting the super powerful avatar psychic body form mode is, like, it's cool. And it sort of shows that he's super powerful and then he's come a far way. But I kind of would have liked if the final part was more of my fault for beating, you know?
Yeah.
Like, when I beat the first and second parts, I definitely felt like I was clever for beating it, or I did a good job at beating it. But with the last part of the boss fight, it feels more like I'm just going with what the game wants me to do.
It feels more like a playable cutscene in kind of a bad way, basically.
Yeah. So, I don't have much else to say about the game, necessarily. We covered pretty much everything I wanted to.
Yeah. So, I do have more to say about the game a little bit. I'll try to keep it brief, but I think that what makes the game so timeless and what makes the game stand out to me personally is that in addition to the actual levels, there's also kind of an aspect of like the evolving hub world, because like the camp itself evolves as you do the levels. And there's so like all of the kids are like funny little personalities and, you know, they all have their own quips. They all have their own moments. I would like to especially shout out what's his name, Vernon, who is like a boy who tells the like longest and most boring stories.
Mm-hmm. I really like RJ, who is just a cowboy.
Yeah, the fucking just all of the really funny, really stupid, like caricatures are kind of used to their fullest.
The two cheerleaders are plotting to destroy the world, and whenever you go up there, they're like, oh, Raz, what are you doing here? We've got a new cheer for you. Yeah, we were just coming up with a new cheer for you. And then they clearly just improv something on the spot.
Yeah. Also, it's JT, I think.
Oh, JT, yeah. It was a J in there somewhere.
Yeah. But the, like, after every level, there is like, it's like time progresses, and it makes it stand out because, like, every kid can be interacted with every item that you have, including Mr. Pokelope, actually. That's a fun little thing. Like, you usually, in a normal game play, do not have Mr. Pokelope for, like, 5 minutes, even. You barely have him for 2 minutes. But, like, if you, instead of bringing him straight to Shigor, like, take him back to the camp, all of the kids will have something to say about it. This is also one of those games where, like, they coded in reactions to things that you wouldn't have. So, like, your confusion grenades, if you use them on Oleander in the very beginning, when you literally could never have access to it, he'll be confused and he'll be like, come back here, Mr. Bunny.
There's also clairvoyances for everybody. Everybody sees Raz differently.
I think that one of the specific ones is like Sasha sees Raz as a little version of himself, which is adorable.
I love that Shigor sees Raz as Christ. It's great. All the dogs in Edgar's level see him differently as well, which is super interesting.
The like, it is a 3D platformer, but it was clearly made by people, like you said, that had like adventure gaming experience, because they took like all, when it came to, you know, the like items and the, you know, world of how it progresses, they took sort of a lot of different things into account when they created it. And it's just like really, really well done. And it's a lot, it makes it much more interesting to go back to in that specific regard than, I don't know, like Battle for Bikini Bottom. Like, Battle for Bikini Bottom is great, but it, you know, that like aspect of, you know, character is usually just like one-off cutscenes, whereas this has its own little ecosystem.
Right. I also love that, like, I love that this game does things that, I love games that represent things with other things. That's very vague, but, like, the way it represents mental concepts is really interesting. Even though, like, for some of the disabilities, it might not be super respectful and kind of uses harmful tropes instead. I think what makes this so interesting in retrospect is that, like, it's another game that really uses the gameplay and the world design to tell the story in ways that the story cannot tell. So, yeah, like, all the, especially the people in the asylum in that second half, like, there's so many small details that you pick up by playing the levels that contribute to the gameplay or the story in some way. You know how Raz is really big in Lungfishopolis because the lungfish was actually afraid of him, or things with, like, with like Edgar in the bull, and like you have to follow the bull the same way Edgar does, or like it will impede your movement the same way it does for Edgar. Like, that's super creative, and I think it's something that games around that era really started doing more, or at least they got more recognition for. So, like, Metal Gear Solid 2, Shadow of the Colossus, and of course Psychonauts, these are all games that really push that that, I don't want to say ludonarrative, that ludic language, gamic language. They push the language of games in a way that I think has progressed the medium, and we are still seeing its influences today.
Yeah. Lewd language, actually. I just looked it up in the dictionary. Really, they should get a synonym for that. Probably might cause some different problems.
Oh, I love talking lewd about language. Lewd language. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm super excited for the sequel, by the way. Jack Black is voicing in it. He also played the main character of Brutal Legend. Jack Black looks like Tim Schafer, so no surprise there.
Yeah, the sequel is ideally coming out, I believe, pretty soon, like a couple of months. And so, you know, hopefully it's better. It's been years in the making. It should be. But like, yeah, it isn't a perfect game by any stretch, but like, it absolutely deserves its cult classic status, and it kind of deserves, like, the classic status as well, I would say.
If there's a game canon, the same way there's, like, a Western canon, I would put this in there.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, I don't have a whole lot else to say unless you do.
All I have to say is thank you for listening. You can follow us on social media at Facebook and Twitter at NetSurferPro. You can get updates on future episodes, future things we're talking about. You can also send us messages about the episodes, talk about the episodes, or give us recommendations for things to cover. You can give us a rating and a like and whatnot on different podcasting platforms, where you can also follow us. Give us any sort of feedback, you know, let people know about us. We really don't do advertising. I know this sounds like a McElroy kind of copying them, but, you know, tell your friends about it, and then have them tell their friends, and then have them tell their friends. Until it becomes a no longer sustainable marketing model. You can follow me on Twitter at Matt Craig Gaming, where I talk about things, post about things, post about what I'm doing, what I'm working on, post links to things, etc. You can also follow me on Twitch at twitch.tv/twack. That's twitch.tv/TWAK. Ah, TWAK. I stream from Monday, Wednesday, Friday, sometimes Tuesday and Thursday. From about 1 p.m. Central Time to 3, 4 p.m. Central Time. I've started two new things, which are on Mondays I'm doing something called The Unpack, where I talk more in-depth about a topic. I have my first VOD out, where it was me talking about roguelikes and roguelites and Rogue Legacy. And then on Fridays I'm doing 47 Friday, which is Hitman streams, where people can actually prevent me from doing things and make it harder for me. So check that out if you're interested in those. And check out whatever Galen's about to mention.
Well, you can follow me on Twitter at Galen at twitter.com/GalenWilson. That's twitter.com/GalenWilson0n. I post my hot takes and retweet whatever interests me at that time. You can follow me on Twitch at twitch.tv/machinegunvampire. I've been playing a lot of City of Heroes, so I might actually start streaming that at some point. I'm not sure. You can find me on YouTube at The Only Galen on YouTube, where I promise I'll have a video sometime within the next decade. And most importantly, go play A Hat in Time. It's a much better game. Yeah. All right, bye.